Thank you for listening to our Conversations About Change, bringing thoughtful perspectives on technology, society, and change to the net every week since October 2004. Here's this week's show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Industry Futures, the 371st Yi10 Tech Community Call on Monday, July 16th, 2012. Yi10 means Conversations About Change in Mandarin. I'm Jerry Mikulski, Yi10's founder. Today I'm in San Francisco, and my co-founder, Pip Coburn, is in New York. Twice a month on the first and third Mondays, we get together to discuss tech topics of interest to investors, executives, and tech-savvy folks like you. Our new format starts with a 45-minute call similar to our classic calls, and then we add a 45-minute period of slower conversation for those who want deeper discourse on the day's topic. As before, you can find supporting resources online at yi10.com, that's yi-tan.com, as well as links to a live chat using IRC. We use Yi10 without the hyphen as our Twitter user ID and hashtag. We also podcast, so you can listen to these conversations when you want to over there on iTunes. This is an interactive call, which means we are all live on the phone together. Please be mindful of this and don't put us on your musical hold. Instead, mute buttons work great, or hit the *6 on your keypad. Then when you want to jump in, the *6 will also uncloak you, and please say your name each time so we know who's speaking. Today's conversation about change looks forward industry by industry, and I think there's a whole bunch of stuff happening in the world, and peeling apart the change and looking at it industry by industry, I think is more interesting than trying to do a really broad sort of thing. And I thought maybe a couple ways would be interesting here. One was to take kind of a 2x2 approach in talking about industries, which would be two time frames and two scenarios. So, and there's no need to do this, but if this might be an interesting framing tool. The two time frames being sort of medium term and long term, and the two scenarios being, well, you're probably going to come in and talk about one scenario, one path that might go. What is that path in opposition to, or what would happen if the opposite happened? So just creating a couple of oppositions that'll give us more to talk about in different ways. So let's dive in. I've got a list of industries to look at, and I'm just going to read off the list and then kind of dive in at the beginning and see what we think. And I think out of this, one thing I'd like to listen for as we go, and anybody who starts seeing these things or has ideas about them, you know, jump in and say so. I think there's larger trends, larger sort of shifts, secular shifts or long-term change shifts going on that are part of what we're talking about. And they will bleed over into many of the different scenarios and industries and sectors as we talk about them. So let me read the list of sectors that came off the top of my head really quickly, which are telecom, money, just money and finance, the whole thing, food, jobs, just the whole employment sector. Where will the jobs be? We've had a Yi10 call about that before. Education. And we've got a couple of Yi10 calls. The next two coming up are going to be deep dives into education. Transport, space travel, space commerce, pharmaceuticals, drugs, wellness, entertainment, prisons, incarceration, the prison industrial complex, and politics and governance. So I think there's a whole bunch of different industry, and this list can go on and on and on, and we have 90 minutes here to talk together. So what I'd like to do is listen for a second in case somebody is on the call and really wants to dive into one of these specifically, and if not, start at the top of the list and start going through them. So let me go quiet for a second and see if there's an industry in particular that one of you would like to take on.
Yeah, this is Dick Karpinski.
Hey, Dick.
I've been looking at the Office of Medical and Scientific Justice, which, among other things, has recently a notice that Harvard, among other places, is accused of having research reports that are, in one case, they did a study 6 times and only reported on the one that gave favorable results for whatever it was they were looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a whole bunch of straightforward fraud in medical research, so much so that former editor of the New York Journal of Medicine said, New England Journal mm-hmm. of Medicine, said that she believed that at least half of the articles that were published in that journal were false. And so this is an ongoing problem that is essentially caused by the fact that research is run by corporations, and corporations are run to make money. So there's not a lot of effort being put forward to make it reliable research.
To straighten it out?
It's Pip.
Pip, jump in. Go ahead.
Just to jump in, because I can see us going down a downward spiral that we spend the time just talking about making matters worse. Dick, I don't think it's fair of you to connect corporations making money and evil. I don't think that's right. I think corporations do have tendencies, and I don't like many of those tendencies, but I think there's also a lot of great things that corporations do as well. So I don't think that's...
Oh, I quite agree. I quite agree.
So, Pip, I think I agree with let's find positive ways out. And I think we're going to see a lot of negative stuff as we talk about the different industries. But I think Dick is trying to say that there's a corruption in the medical research business that is about the relationship between business and universities and research labs and all that. And I was hoping, the place I was hoping to take you, Dick, was, so looking forward, is there a way this gets straightened out, or is there a way this just gets worse and worse? And what we have is, you know, like we have a lot of regulatory capture, we have research capture. And Pip, I want thank you for jumping in. One thing that happens every now and then is that we say negative things about businesses, and sometimes the statements come out as blanket statements, but also we can't ignore some of the negative that happens in the world. So let's try to walk that fine line conversationally here as we dive in. But Dick, can you take us extrapolate what you're talking about and look further ahead?
Well, the good side of it is that if we can expose some of this stuff very explicitly, then we can correct it. And the mode of correcting things is reasonably, I mean, we're familiar with ways that this has happened on occasion, and we just have to strengthen those ways so that we can
rather
get better.
Dick, rather than prescribing what we might do today that would fix it, do you think that's going to happen? I just listened last night to Don Tapscott's opening talk for the TED Global, and he's pretty optimistic. He says, look, you know, on the whole, I'm pretty optimistic that this world we're walking into, which has lots more openness, and one of his four principles of openness is the kind of transparency that you're talking about that would fix this. So I think I'm asking for either historic references, can you look back on the historic record where things like this that were similar happened that you can say, okay, good, there might be a movement like that happening, or things happening on the street today that have convinced you that we're heading toward a more open world where these things will be uncovered and fixed? And I'm sorry to push on you, but I want to stay true to the theme of the call and look ahead quite a ways.
Yes, well, one of the best things that I've come across recently was the business about how violence is being reduced in terms of the likelihood of any given person to be adversely affected by violence from another human. And that's The Better Angels of Our Nature is the name of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite promising in the sense that there are things that were commonplace just 50, 60, 70 years ago that are unthinkable now. Mm-hmm. They're so cruel that we would not be pleased with that. You know, it's gross, but there were people who went to the theater in regular town to see cats killed by being lowered in cages onto fires.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, come on, nobody would do that these days. And yet it was common not 100 years ago.
That's probably a form of entertainment I didn't need to know existed.
Yep.
But thank you. So that's a general optimistic thing. It's not necessarily about transparency and so forth, but thank you for putting the issue on the table.
Well, but the other aspect of it is that we have the internet now, and mm-hmm. that gives us some opportunities for transparency that have never been available to anyone in prior decades and centuries.
Yep. And that reminds me that an item I didn't put on my list of industries is the internet. And I think there's an interesting conversation that we've touched on in a few U10 calls about net neutrality, freedom to connect. Jonathan Zittrain was our guest some many months back about whether the internet stays the internet over time. Because I agree with you that the general forces and trends that the internet lets loose on the world favor the kind of transparency you're talking about. So thank you. Anyone else with thoughts on this, either on transparency itself as a movement or on the sort of medical research college relationships?
This is Bo.
Yes, Bo.
I was reading a while ago that they do these brain implants and MRIs and everything, And that is actually going sort of open source, and people are making them, but because of the laws right now, they can only make smaller ones. And a lot of these devices have code, like these implants, that is not open source. So I see open sourcing of that, and I see when you're talking about the printers and things being able to make that, people in I hate the term third world, whatever, are going to be able to make their own MRIs and medical equipment, and that will go open source. So that is a really cool thing. I'm very excited about that.
So there's a couple things you're saying here. I think like the open sourcing of medical device hardware, including the local fabbing of a lot of it.
Yes. And right now, for example, in the Western world, they're doing it, but they can't make them large because of the laws and stuff like that. But I see a time when that ends, you know, where it's just, hey, wait a minute, we're talking about saving real lives here, so sorry, we're going to do it, or some law changed or something like that.
Interesting.
Because we saw in the last decade with the WTO thing that happened in the 90s, and they're saying, hey, what about AIDS and everything? And sure enough, the world did respond, and we, the United States, put a whole lot of money into Africa with cheap AIDS medicine. So, you know, those WTO protesters did actually achieve what they wanted to in some part. And I just don't, you know, it's inhuman to withhold these kind of things to developing countries and stuff like that.
That's
a wonderful thing.
There was just some correspondence I was just through about implantable cardioverter defibrillators, or ICDs, and a fellow who's got one implanted, and he can't crack the company to give him access to the data coming off it, because it's got telemetry coming off, right? It's a Wall Street...
I was reading that, and I came to another conclusion. I wanted to write a blog post on it, but I'll just say it on the call. So they're also doing implants that amp up some of your brain functions, so you could tune your brain. I just see a time when people are going to have implants, and there's also implants that can affect your vision too, that you see. So I see hackathons with people sitting there hacking their brains on how to let's amp up my concentration or my smell or my sight or whatever. So I see that happening, and that would be pretty interesting. I mean,
so,
it's just an immediate deductive thing.
Yeah, so it's kind of like tuner culture from cars showing up at the quantified self doorstep?
Yeah, and it's because these implants can stimulate certain parts of the brain. So Kirsten going to have neuroscientists sitting there along with them, and there's certainly a little bit of danger, but I see that as something they're not going to be able to stop. That'll be pretty interesting because you've heard of the super enabled people, like the people who have lost their legs but have these medical, you know, these physical things on there. So I could see a time when we'll have super enabled people because they have the right implant and they have the right code in it to their own brain.
Yep. And right now there's the Olympic athlete who didn't qualify, I think, in the Olympic trials for the sprints. So the controversy has been headed off. I'm forgetting his name exactly, but the para-athlete who was trying to be in the sprints. And then there's the woman who gave the TED talk showing her various variety of leg extensions because she was born without any bones in her lower legs. So and that's just leg extremities. So there's a whole bunch of exoskeleton work being done in the military that seems to be moving ahead pretty quickly. I mean, and you're taking me into the area that I think we need to have a future Yitan call about, which is sort of security and the world of autonomous flying drones and all that. But let's not go there right now.
Yeah, there was a guy who, what do they call it, when all his limbs are cut off, he just swam between Spain and North Africa.
Wow.
With all extensions and stuff. So, I mean, wow.
Yeah, Peter Kapik is saying on the IRC that he's looking forward to, maybe we can look forward to medical data in general being made available to patients who want it. In New York, a lab may not give results other than to a doctor, except for blood type. So... yeah, we have such a long way to opening these things up. And the problem is that in hacker spaces and in other kinds of hardware hacking, as long as you're not opening up the body and dropping something inside, it's really easy to envision fabbing, hacking, other kinds of stuff, doing pretty marvelous things. The second you get close to surgery, at least I get a little skeptical about how we're going to wind up doing our own surgery. But maybe what will happen is there'll be a class of surgeries which are implanting of devices that people hack themselves. I don't know how that's going to work. That sounds a bit further out there than maybe our horizon here. I don't know. Maybe it's already happening. I mean, there are cochlear implants that are doing brilliant things and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I see a little bit of fright in that because I'm a little worried about, you know, if someone has a psychological disorder with those implants, you know, you could tip their brain in the wrong direction.
Yep, yep.
Also, you're familiar with Sheldon Rankin's Nitinous and everything, right?
Yep.
Really, okay, because, man, that thing, that really explains the world really good. I mean, I could read part of it off because it really shows a difference. It is a hallmark of what you're talking about, transparency and everything. Like, do you want me to read a little bit or something of that or what?
Can you post a link on the IRC?
Well, you know, Sheldon's talking about how people and things and everything are getting connected. And the more things that we have, networks, locations, devices, points, and intimacy, and all these things get connected and they become fields, and then everybody gets entangled. And so we have loosely connected, closely connected, embedded. And the fourth state that is emerging is loosely connected, closely connected, embedded, entangled.
Mm.
So the two worlds of atoms and bits become one, and so we're going beyond Metcalfe's Reed's law, the network effect, externality effect, the power of collaboration, summation, more data, more points of view. So everything's going to get connected. I'll just give you one little example of that. I think this is going to change so many things in this world. By the way, you increase safety, capability, and opportunity by doing this.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me a great example because I guess I really can't do this whole presentation here. But let's say you're in a bathtub, and your bathtub can reformulate itself, you know, and in your older person, you fall. Well, the bathtub reshapes itself to stop your fall, automatically calls your relatives and 911. I mean, that's the world that's coming right down the pipe.
Hmm.
And, you know, and you can already see that, the amount of intelligence now built into a car with GM OnStar. I mean, an average car has more computing power than the first things we sent to the moon. And all these, when you have this ubiquitous connectivity, your car becomes a platform, you know, your house becomes a platform, it all gets connected.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to have tremendous effects on, and beneficial effects all over the place.
So, Bo, could you post a link to the IRC? This is Sheldon Renan's essay on netness, which is a lovely essay, and Sheldon's been thinking about that a lot, but Michael Dresden asked for it on the IRC, so it'd be great to have it there. Also, I will say as a side note to offer the contrary point of view about the Internet of Things, I recently got quoted in some write-ups on the new Pew Internet Research Survey about the Internet of Things, and I'm pretty much a skeptic about it. I think that the complexity of this, and in particular, the fact that in the field, anything that's shipped into the field basically is maybe upgradable, firmware upgradable for a little while, but pretty rapidly obsolete, and that security is effectively going to destroy all those things, that if everything is addressable and actuatable, all of a sudden this is a hacker's dream come true. Never mind the natural complexity of all these things interacting in the world and the unintended consequences of their showing up next to each other when they weren't programmed to understand what it means for, you know, the banana slug to meet the Segway.
This is very interesting because I actually thought of this, but I was never going to blog it. Let's say there's a person who worked with George W. Bush, who happens to have a heart, you know, defibrillator implant built in.
Mm-hmm.
You could see someone hacking that and assassinating people.
Oh, for sure. That's one of the worries about opening up any communication with these devices, for sure.
And this person, of course, is very hated. But anyway, I was never going to post that because I do not want the FBI knocking down my door.
That's probably a good idea.
Yes, but I was thinking to myself, oh my God, if I got one of those implants, I'd be like, okay, what are the security measures here?
Yeah. So let me move over for a second while we're near sort of wellness hacking, all this kind of stuff. Let me just move over to pharmaceuticals and ask a question of anybody who wants to jump in, which is as follows. In Don Tapscott's TED opening talk, one of the first things he says is, look, the pharmaceutical industry is facing a patent cliff. Basically, in the next year, in the next 12 months, 25% of the things they're really counting on making money off of right now fall out of patent. And there's all sorts of ways in which they're trying to protect the patents, extend the patents, create patent walls. You can go read Rembrandt's In the Attic if you want to learn more about that. But what's the future of pharma and drugs and well-being look like? Because there's a lot of other things happening in the industry that I find really, really deeply promising, but they may not look like the traditional pharma industry. And we may figure out how to crowdsource FDA trials. I don't know. What does everybody think about that broad field?
This is Mike Nelson in Washington. I think what's been fascinating is to see some of the major companies moving into devices and particularly devices that people need all the time. I have a relative who has sleep apnea, and every few months somebody's calling and saying, oh, you need to replace your equipment, and you know, this is it's one of those wonderful annuities that the companies get because somebody has this for a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to sleep better, if you're a sleep apnea patient, you need this you wear this mask, and the mask has parts that should be either cleaned extensively or replaced
mm-hmm.
every 3 or 4 months. And I think some of these things probably could be designed so they didn't need to be replaced or could be easily maintained on your own. But I swear they're coming up with ways to make sure that you always have to keep paying them money. And I think there's other places like this where we're starting to see homegrown remedies that you'll pay money for year in and year out.
Mm-hmm.
And allergies, rather than putting a drug in your system, there's a 4,000-year-old technology developed in India called the Neti Pot. Have you heard about this?
This is going to really sound strange, but I ordered a Waterpik Neti Pot this morning online.
And if you
I just had to confess
some,
that
there's probably some product. There's some product you have to buy. You probably have to buy some special solution.
They want to sell you saline solution, but saline is really easy to make, so I'm not worried about that.
Yeah, but I'm sure they have a special saline solution. It's a bit like contacts. The contacts are the same thing. I'm sure there's a way to do all the things that you do with contact lenses without having to buy the special materials.
Yeah.
They have this wonderful system set up where you just keep paying in. It's not quite as lucrative as pills that cost $10 a shot, but if you
if you're in business, if you're in business, there's nothing like annuity revenues, right? You want preferably perpetuities, but annuities will do just fine, thank you, if they last a long time. I don't find anything wrong with annuity revenues if there's really good value being exchanged. And there's a lot of people saying that we're entering a sharing economy where access trumps ownership, in which case we will be paying for things sort of in little dribs and drabs over time all the time, unless somebody else has it and we're sharing it for free. But if you're in business, you'd rather have, you know, small amounts of money coming in for a long period of time. That makes for a business that's more stable than a hit product every couple of years, and you either sell several billion dollars worth or you sell nada, right?
Yes, that's huge risk. That's all.
So the key is to convince people that they have more diseases than they know about, and that they have to take care of them all.
Well, that's a good.
The latest one is restless leg syndrome, I guess, and. You know, if we're all being monitored, we'll all know if we're shaking our leg at night and need to take a new drug for that.
Well, it's funny because in the whole health, wellness, medicine, et cetera world, there are all these very interesting forces flowing together, including, and I'll throw in one thing I'm really optimistic about here, maybe overly so, but people are beginning to study the microbiome. Basically, we've been busy trying to kill germs and get rid of things that are bad for us. And people are starting to take very seriously this confluence of gut bacteria and other bacteria on our bodies. There's a couple really great TED Talks and other talks you can go watch to get a little more informed about what's going on. But it turns out that obesity may be affected in a pretty large way by your gut biome. And there may be many therapeutic interventions possible here at pretty low cost. Once you think about what's going on here, you know, you could eat the equivalent of a probiotic yogurt, could recharge your biome and mingle it with someone else's who has things you need, for example. And they're starting to realize that health and wellness are really desperately complicated, and we need to stop treating the body as a mechanism with a broken part that you can take out and fix. So I don't know what that does to the pharma industries, and I'm sure they're busy researching these areas as well.
Well, a couple of things. One is pharma, I think, is a business model like, hey, you know, you hit the jackpot on the slot machine, and they just, you know, say, hey, I want another jackpot, please.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's sort of a broken expectation. But I look at what pharma did with depression in Japan. depression didn't used to be in the Japanese lexicon. You know, if somebody was sad, they were just sad. But all of a sudden, backed by big PR agencies, there were all these articles about depression and it's a chemical imbalance, et cetera, et cetera. And now they are gigantic consumers of anti-depression medication. And, you know, to me, it's just crazy to, you know, go and teach people to recognize various disease conditions that didn't used to affect them, or you can pump more pills.
So let's talk about the future of mood meds here for a second. This sounds like if you could get a whole bunch of people using a whole bunch of mood controllers or mood boosters or performance boosters, any number of those things. It started back with Bo talking about, you know, the opening of fMRIs and all that. That's, you know, long-term industry revenues if they can do it, right?
You bet.
Well, this is Terpinski again.
Yeah, Dick.
Super Better is a completely different way of accomplishing that sort of thing. It's a game, and there's been a TED Talk about it, and you can find Super Better on the net, but it's a game where you engage other people to help you deal with, for instance, your depression.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Dick, go ahead.
No, it just doesn't take drugs. That's all I'm saying.
Fabulous. And I'm with you on this entirely. I think another big thing that's happening is we're starting to figure out how to come together in community to help each other exercise, to help each other get better. Super Better was started by Jane McGonigal, who's given a couple really excellent TED Talks and other talks. And it happened because she started getting migraines. She had a head trauma and started getting really bad migraines that she couldn't get out from under. And she developed Super Better to help herself. It was what did she call it? The Jane, the headache killer or something rather early on. Anyway, the problem with things like Super Better is that it's really good for one little startup called Super Better, and it's not so good for a lot of people trying to sell medications and devices and all the other stuff we're talking about. So it's not good for GDP. It's really good for general wellness. Is that a big, let me just flip it around. I see that as a really big trend. I see a lot of things happening that are very low cost and are social or are locally constructed and locally invented and not locked up at the detriment of GDP and the Dow, but at the benefit to society. Does that resonate for anybody?
Cool if you can do it.
Jerry, it just means that people won't spend money on antidepressants because they're happier. Instead, they'll spend money on getting in better shape and training and living longer or going to a concert or doing something higher up on Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
That's good.
This isn't like the money is pulled out of the economy. It's, you know, rather than limping around with a broken leg that didn't heal properly, you'll be doing ballet or getting massage or, I mean, whatever. You'll spend money on something else.
Or going on archaeological expeditions. Go ahead, Jay.
I have a tragic counterexample. A good friend of mine got really severe Parkinson's. And when I last saw him, you know, I had to have help to crawl into bed. And we were talking, and he pulls a little vial of Viagra out of his pocket. And he goes, in case I get lucky, you know. And it was dream time. I mean, you know, this guy couldn't get his own pants off. And yet the Viagra was here to, you know, give him a psychological boost.
Mm-hmm.
I have to wonder. Of course, also there's the thing of placebos work, and the latest research is they work even if you know they're placebos.
Yep. It's interesting. So another angle here, just following some neighboring threads, is this whole neuro-everything and the psychology of the self and all the current best-selling books that are coming out about our fallacies and biases and other foibles. And whether we'll start to understand how to do this. And that's right next door to the life hacking and quantified self and participatory medicine worlds, which are trying to figure out, okay, great, so how do we actually counteract these or leverage them, right, in different ways? How do we hack our lifestyles to do better? Does anybody think we're going to start figuring out how humans work in the next 20, 30 years?
The ad people will do that for us.
Oh, perfect.
Not the medical people.
They already have.
I'm glad we've effectively outsourced that one. Jeff, you boys posted a couple of nice links about mood drugs and cognitive enhancers on the chat. Thank you, Jeff.
I'm astonished to see the one. I mean, I'm just browsing statistics. This is a number of people on antidepressants doubled between 96 and 2005.
And 96 to 2005? Wow.
Yeah. You know, in the sort of the Huxley versus Orwell version of the future, Huxley's winning that round.
Yeah.
It may be an anomaly. Bush was in office for most of that time.
Causation is not.
That's right.
Right, correlation and consequence.
That's right. Super. Well, let's bounce up for a second and take another sector. Who would like to nominate a different sector than the health, wellness, pharma, et cetera, complex that we've been talking about?
Finance sector.
Finance. Nice. Nice, Bo. Take us in.
Well, there's a study out by the IMF that when, first of all, for years, the economists and others have noted that our finance sector has been a really much larger proportion of GDP than it was before, and suspiciously so.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, so what the IMF came out with a study, so I can just give you the facts, that the country's growth, private sector debt I'm talking about, when it's 80 to 100% of GDP, that the debt is productive. But once it goes past that, it's no longer productive. In fact, it doesn't help growth at all. We are currently at 200% of GDP. So we're in a really unproductive level. So I foresee that finance, you know, with all of the latest scandals and everything, financial innovation, end quote, is going to go down, and people we're going to have to take care of this debt and everything, which is a big problem because companies, by the way, get to write off debt a lot better than they can issuing stock. So it's built into the laws. It's built into everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely see a time where we're going to use debt a lot differently and understand it better. Because frankly, I think even current economics and finance don't really understand how deleterious debt can be for people. So I see that. I mean, now the numbers, the studies are coming out, and we all know it's a bigger. We've always presented. End of my talk. Done.
I just finished reading.
Where can we find a reference on that study? That sounds like a very good factoid to have in your pocket.
Okay, I'm going to copy the link.
Awesome. Thanks, Bo.
It's a PDF report from the IMF, so here we go.
Great.
Go ahead, gentlemen.
So I see, maybe I'm limiting the way I'm thinking about this, but I see three kind of scenarios moving forward for financial innovations and finance in general. Scenario one is that the status quo just continues, that we stay with the financial systems we have, the derivatives and too big to fail kind of keeps going, and they sort of skirt the edge of the cliff and they continue growing and circling the wagons. Scenario two is that there's a new wave of regulation that comes in. We roll some form of Glass-Steagall back in, a whole bunch of other things come back in through somebody's regime. I know. Well, there's an election, a big election coming up, right? And that there's re-regulation that takes us back into the, you know, trust-breaking eras or whatever else. There are these cycles of re-regulation and deregulation that happen regularly. Ooh, bad pun. And I'm interested in whether we might be going into those. And the third scenario that arises for me is, you know, the whole thing hits a wall and money breaks. And I know a couple pretty smart people who think that in the next 5 to 10 years, the monetary system as we know it breaks really badly. And I think the least of the ways that would happen is to, you know, fall into a hyperinflationary scenario. But there's many other ways in which money might just break. So anybody feel strongly about it, any of those scenarios, or want to add a fourth or a fifth?
I want to add that deflation is also a problem too, because when debt starts to fail, money disappears in reverse. So we could have deflation first, then inflation. So it could be a lot more, and there's another IMF report going into that.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be more complicated than that. But yeah, I think there's about a 60% chance that bad case scenario you're talking about is going to happen, because if you add up public and private debt, it is so enormous. It's more like, you know, 400-500% of GDP.
Yeah.
And that, ugh, you know, it's just, and I'm going to stop now.
No, that's great. Thanks, Bo.
You got to have views on this.
That's right. Anybody else? Jump in. Finance.
I'm curious about what's going to happen with the euro. You know, is the risk priced into the euro? Is the euro going to hang together? If the eurozone splits, what's going to be the result of that?
Yeah. And they're basically whistling past the graveyard right now as you know, every little bit of seemingly good news is causing some lift in those markets. But it feels like all the stuff that's still problematic for the euro is still buried in there, right?
One of the most interesting scenarios is that the euro continues, but many of the large transactions start to take place in a different currency. Yeah, before the euro was made the official currency of the whole region, they had this pseudo-currency that was used for major moves of currency across boundaries. And so it is possible, and throughout history, this has actually been more likely than less. You know, in the early U.S., in the early colonies, people were using three or four different currencies. The reason we talk about, you know, two bits, four bits is because we were using the Spanish doubloons, and you broke them in half and gave people four bits of the that you could actually break them into eight different pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually maybe what's going to happen with the euro. Is you'll actually see some other currencies start to circulate.
Yeah. Also,
and people will start taking out loans in foreign currencies because it's more
ready
stable.
For Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like
oh,
Bitcoin.
Well, Bitcoin's a whole other question.
Was that Pip, by the way, Jerry?
I don't think it was.
Mike Nelson.
I've also heard of right now they're already using, I believe, commodity-backed currencies. So, you know, it's backed by a set of commodities.
Yeah.
So I've also been hearing that on loans.
So there's a currency called the VEN, which is a market basket currency, which is pretty interesting. And the founder is, I had his name a second ago, but he's gone right now. Stan Stalnaker is the founder of the VEN. And I heard him talk once, and I was like, wow, this is the next Mark Zuckerberg, because he's really got an interesting idea. And the VEN is now tradable on Thomson Reuters terminals, so it's kind of pretty legit. And it might be a way of evening out some of these flows. I don't know. But I'm halfway through reading 1493, which is another book by Charles Mann, who wrote 1491 about the history of the Americas before Columbus. So 1493 is about the Great Columbian Exchange. And then I want to have a Yitan call about what's happening today that's parallel to that. But one of the many really interesting things that Mann says in 1493 is that China, way back when, really had two currency systems, just like what Mike described. That small transactions were done in small brass coins that had a square hole in them that were of very low denomination. In fact, low enough denomination that if you bought something substantial, you might bring a wheelbarrow full of coins, and that they were strung together on ropes or strings because of the holes through the middle. But that all of the larger things were done in silver. And China wound up with this inexhaustible appetite for silver, which is why when Europe discovers the Potosí mines in Bolivia and starts drawing silver out of South America, all hell breaks loose everywhere. I mean, that just opens up these transatlantic and trans-Pacific shifts that we're still sort of feeling reverberations from. So there are plenty of examples for tiered currency systems where things happen at different levels in completely different ways. Anyone else want to jump in on the finance conjectures here?
Do we want to touch income inequality on this one, or income distribution on this one too?
Love that. Dive in.
I just, it's interesting that that's become a speakable term, right? I mean, it was absolutely unspeakable as part of political discourse not that long ago, and now it is part of public discussion. It doesn't seem like it's really yet all that fact-based. Like, it would be nice to see more comparisons between societies that have different patterns of distribution.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you wonder, is it possible to concentrate, you know, how are wealth concentrations going to play out between citizens in this country, but also around the world?
Mm-hmm. And typically,
I don't have any profound insight into it. It seems like it's a topic that has trended upward and has, people with lots of furiously held beliefs debating the point.
But I think there are two things that lead to different kinds of revolutions. One is food scarcities. And we're seeing that happen in lots of different places. And the other one is sharply increased income inequality. And either of those will cause all sorts of ruckus politically over the longer-term waves.
I wish I had it, but The Economist published a really fascinating article months ago. And I think I published it. Okay, there's a couple things going on with that. So, incomes have not been growing for a long time now. And quantitative easing and all the stuff the Fed's been doing has actually done nothing but to worsen the situation. But the real heart of it in America is that America now has a genuine underclass like Europe does because of 40 years of failure in the educational system and also the rate at which people get incarcerated who don't graduate high school. They are permanently unemployable. And so we're also seeing the last
thing which happened in Europe is so you have a whole bunch of people permanently on disability, and that is now happening in America.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are numbers, and it's all backed up, and we do have a real underclass. And that underclass, these people, the economist said, well, you know, Jimmy Carter did job training and stuff. If we did job training with industry, we could perhaps pull our way out of this. But for 40 years, we've been throwing people away in the public with the, you know, the laws of mandatory sentencing and our poor school system and all these people dropping out. And we have a real underclass now.
Mm-hmm.
So
Bo, do you want to
real society.
Bo, do you want to run that forward in the spirit of this call topic and put a conjecture out there that this just keeps getting worse, or we start to figure out what to do about it? I mean, how does it feel that it goes forward?
Okay, well, I think you could speak to all the revolutions that are happening in education. And I think that that's going to happen. We just can't throw away all our future generations. And as China and other countries get more wealthy, we cannot expect that we can just, they come into our schools and we'll be able to, you know, rip off best talent from other countries. We're going to have to at some point stop throwing away our own people. So, you know, I think this seniority-based system and our public school systems, all the bureaucrats above them force-feeding the state curriculums and everything, I think it's gonna start there. There's people both on the left and the right that know these problems,
yeah,
going after it. And bright future for me is we can't afford to throw away all these people and incarcerate them.
Yeah.
We've already seen in the last like 5 years all kinds of states rolling back all these laws for mandatory incarceration because they can't afford to incarcerate the people. That's one leg of the stool that's falling down. I mean, being taken away all of mandatory sentencing for whatever, for minor drug possession or whatever. And you tell me, Jerry, but I think our education system, I think our culture is hitting a tipping point where, hey, we really got to do something. We just can't throw our own children away like this.
Yeah. The problem is that a lot of parts of the educational system are congenitally dysfunctional and will not be easy to reform from the inside. And we'll see this in the next two U10 calls in a couple of different ways, I think. But I see, and I might be overly optimistic here, and I might be off on the time frame, because I think it's going to happen in 10 years, but it might take 30 or 40 years to do. But I see our educational system being eaten or revolutionized from the outside in. I see a lot, yeah, of really beautiful ways of learning growing organically and through businesses and a bunch of other mechanisms outside the traditional school system at any grade you name, all the way from kindergarten up through advanced university. And I see alternative ways of learning and getting people to know what you know and thereby getting employed just becoming a part of how we work together. You can see it in certain areas now. You can already see it in little sort of evidence of in the geek community, you know, programmers and coders shift jobs very differently from the normal resume approach that happens in much of the rest of the world's employment market. So I see education being very ripe for revolution, devolution, and it may well happen.
Yeah, I suggest. And nothing could be a better example of that here in the Bay Area, Oakland, and across the Bay is San Francisco and Silicon Valley. I mean, you can't. That's a microcosm of the whole nation right here.
Although we're sometimes a couple of sigmas off the mean, I'm afraid.
Yes. It's even starker than the rest of the nation. Actually,
yeah.
Starker.
Yeah.
Okay. I agree with you, and it'll happen from outside. Yes. Because parents themselves don't want to let their kids, want their own kids to go down.
Right. Exactly. Nobody wants to close opportunities for their children off. And if the system still seems to require certain things, whether it's a degree or accreditation or this or that or the other certification, if the system still seems to always need those things, then when you don't follow the fish ladder, you are doing damage to your children's future. So very few people want to do that. And so I think it's very hard to shake some traditional models of what's going on. But I see a lot of people making very eloquent cases for how to think differently, and much, much more importantly, I think, I see a lot of small organizations, not all of them for profit, doing really clever and beautiful work to create new learning platforms, new places to learn, new ways of learning, new practices.
Hey, what about Jay? Jay, you're on the call. What do you think?
Jay, Mr. Informal Learning.
Well, Jay was taking a little break to look at email.
We were just talking about maybe the educational system being eaten from the outside in and about all these new and interesting platforms. And you've done so much work in informal learning, which is a lovely, and I think you've reframed it also as working smarter.
Well, definitely. But now one thing is the divide between sort of education and what happens in corporations. And I focus very much on the purposeful learning, which has the goal of, you know, doing things differently and having people be more fulfilled by what they're doing. And this is a transfer of control is what it's about. It's letting people be more autonomous in their choices. And I see it as just shucking off the industrial age notion that people are cogs in the machine made to conform into, hey, this is the way value is created, and hey, extra bonus, you can feel good about it too. I just came from a weekend with the U.S. contingent of the STOS gathering who are into reinventing business. And our whole thing is looking at businesses as dynamic networks of people who are continuously learning, and because that's the road to progress. So it's a lot more than the informal learning, which is just sort of one piece of handing more control and autonomy to the people who are doing the learning. This is affecting colleges too.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, do your own thing, attend a MOOC, go to MITx, whatever. But that one, I think one of the big changes coming along is, you know, if costs keep going up and perceived value, especially in the getting a job, keeps going down, this dog won't hunt, you know. People are going to take their own learning, well, they're going to do without the credentials and these sort of super-duper resume type things to explain what they've learned.
Mm-hmm.
I think the higher education bubble's ready to burst.
Jay, it's so great to hear. Did you hear Jerry's earlier comments? So you think it's going to come from outside the system and it's just going to be, right? Is that, you agree with Jerry on that?
Well, the thing is, it's different in the United States than it is other places. I was amazed when I was in India a few months ago to find the way that they want to essentially educate 800 million people. So what do they want to do? They say, well, let's just build 30,000 new colleges. And, you know, they can't separate the formal structure from people learning things. So they're going a different direction than we are. I mean, we're going to be, you know, tearing down buildings and converting campuses into resorts, and they're going to have a building boom of for-profit colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the pressures in this country is coming from all directions.
Agreed. Totally agreed. Cool. Anybody else with notions on education and income inequality, the last couple topics we've touched? Jump on in.
This is Mike Nelson, being a professor at Georgetown. I care a lot about this. But it seems to me the big question is going to be what happens to credentials?
Mm-hmm.
And will we have LinkedIn and the kind of endorsements you see there replacing the endorsement of Georgetown University or Harvard? And will there be some other way in which you'll go through filters that will prove that you are an incredibly talented person worthy of being hired? That to me seems that will change everything for the universities, because the universities now have this monopoly on granting the degree that says you are a worthwhile, well-educated person.
Yep.
Mike, don't you have to sort of segment the market? I mean, Georgetown and Harvard, they're going to be around, no question.
They'll be around because they give people access to networks. And that's the other big question, is whether that's going to be less important, whether there'll be some other way to build a high-quality network in the future. But I agree with your point. I mean, Harvard is not going anywhere. It's got enough money to live forever, but and enough of a reputation, enough alumni. But if you're looking forward to a nice career somewhere, it may be that you do something different than a four-year degree.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I'm most excited about is the idea that you'll go to school for a year or two and then try something for 8 years, and then you'll go back for another couple of years. I think that's a more sane way to live, if nothing, because otherwise you get totally burnt out or bored and you stagnate.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that our work-life education rhythms are probably going to shift, is kind of what you're saying, right, Mike, right?
Right. And why the hell do we retire at 60 or 65? I mean, why not, scatter a few years of retirement living in between your work years and live and work until you're 70 or 75?
Yep.
That's the other thing that could be a huge shift in how people's lives are lived. I always look at the big questions, you know, how do people spend their time every day?
Mm-hmm.
And how will people subdivide their life? And when you look at major cultural changes, those are the things that change. People are, instead of going to work when they're 16, they're now going to work when they're 26.
Mm-hmm.
That was a profound change. And likewise, the advent of television, which now takes up 3 or 4 hours of the average American's time, that's a profound change. And the shift from television to internet, that's a profound change. But very few people look at time budgets when they're trying to understand the future.
Mr. Karpinski, I would say that we're having a lot more flexibility in what constitutes a job. And we have a lot more people who are making their own jobs and working from home and stuff like that. So it may be that the notion of a job that you have for decades
mm-hmm.
is going to disappear, and you have a job for a month or three. Look at how they make movies in L.A., and
mm-hmm.
there's a crew that comes together, 50, 60, 75 people, and 4 months later, they're someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
And they are succeeding at one of those things that we seem to do better than anywhere else in the world, making movies. I mean, now they're doing pretty well in India, but
yeah.
Than that, it requires a very different approach to jobs than we have in the rest of our society.
Yep.
Movie business, though, because their healthcare goes with them. There is a great story, a great article in the latest issue of the Harvard Business Review, maybe last month, on the rise of the super temp.
Yeah.
About high-level professionals who do these gigs and do 6 months here, 12 months there. I think the word of the year should be gigonomics to describe exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we have Medicare for all, then the question of affordable health care is sort of irrelevant. So there's many reasons why more flexibility, less stability for the individual, because the individual is going to be seeing a different environment very frequently.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things
it's
we did...
Obama's biggest contribution to innovation policy, if he succeeds, is the healthcare plan.
Yeah. One of the things that happened accidentally out of World War II is that we tied healthcare to corporations. And so when you leave a corporation, you lose your health care, which is actually, in my mind, ridiculous. But that creates this real desire not to leave businesses. And I remember 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, meeting a guy from IBM who was close to retirement. And he and his wife had a Down's child early on. And he was already an IBM employee. And IBM had really generous benefits for that. And when they had that baby, he knew that he had to stay working at IBM. He couldn't lose that job. He had to do whatever he could to stay there, and he had to retire the day he was eligible, because the way things were working, at least that way he might get grandfathered into whatever benefits he had, and that could maybe lock in. That was his strategy. And it was all because of a condition of birth, right? And that struck me as a really large tragedy, kind of a first world tragedy, but still a tragedy. So anybody want to propose one more sector to go look into?
Well, this is Mike Nelson in Washington. Maybe it's not the right sector, but I'd love to hear 3 minutes on the future of government. Because
mm-hmm.
I think radical things are going to happen here, particularly if we combine all this, the idea of sensor nets, big data, social media. Once we get identity right, there's just all sorts of things start to happen very differently. If instead of companies having to file all these reports on compliance, if their information system is connected in a very careful way to some giant computer at the SEC or the EPA or somewhere else, so that those agencies automatically just continually monitor to make sure that companies are within, you know, are behaving well. I mean, it could lead to a very different type of relationship between citizens and the government and companies. and a much more flexible one, you know, because right now there's this idea that regulatory agencies have to come in and say, this is what our goal is, and in order to achieve that goal, you all have to do exactly the same thing this way. This new world could be very different, where you set the goal and every company can meet the goal in a different way and document it by these automatic data systems that are generating the data that they need to run their company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a sort of a government transparency leading to autonomic regulation, or I think Tim O'Reilly calls it algorithmic regulation.
I love that point, Mike. There's
yeah.
an example of it right now, by the way. Most people don't know that Colorado has the most regulated, legalized pot situation going. And what they've done is they were really worried. They got busted, just like here in California. So the growers and the sellers demanded to be regulated by the state of Colorado. And they put this guy in. Their first concern was, you know, bad, the mob and other people, gangs getting into it. So that's how it is. All of the stuff, all of the finances, everything are fed directly into the this building. Not only that, video feeds from all the growing houses, the back doors, the front doors, inside, and also the selling houses is done. So they have that. That's actually happening right now in Colorado with their legalized pot industry.
That's a fascinating case study. Putin did the same thing for the Russian election. He put cameras in every voting place, and they just tried to make it very transparent so nobody could accuse anybody of breaking in and stuffing the ballot box.
Who did that?
Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, in order to counter all these accusations that he was rigging the election, they put webcams in 10,000 different voting places and put electronic locks on ballot boxes and sensors. And at the end, of course, he rigged the election by not allowing his opponents to use the media,
yeah,
and by locking up or disqualifying the people who actually had a chance to beat him. But at least he used the technology to make it appear that he was running a real election.
That's fascinating. I hadn't heard that.
Hey, this is Pete Lydon.
Hey,
been
Pete.
Lurking here. Sorry, in San Francisco. Hey, Jerry. Yeah, no, I don't. I'm not a normal regular here, but occasionally pop in, and so I've been just kind of listening here, trying to get in back in the vibe a little bit here. But this is a space that I've been thinking a lot about, as Jerry knows, and it's one that I actually do believe. I think we're on the verge of some really, really big changes and widespread innovation across all government. I mean, the basic way I think about this, if just to step back, I kind of left the private sector to get involved in the politics piece of how to use these new tools to change doing politics, the way you win in politics, which was from 2004 to 2008. And then I actually was a little ahead of the game thinking that we were going to actually have the revolution in government really hit hard right after that, and kind of made a bet on a company that I was involved with, which was mildly successful. But I think the way to think of it is my own company was Next Agenda. We were kind of trying to see if we could push the boundaries on web collaboration and link a lot more video connections from physical meetings to the web, and then get collaboration around that. Thinking that there'd be a lot more scaling up of figuring out the next big political kind of transformation. I think it was a little ahead of the game just on the tools side, and that's a kind of side thing I could describe. But basically, I do think what's happened in the last 4 years is, with O'Reilly and several others, there's been a lot of experimentation in government using new technologies and big data, among other things. There's also been both sides, the Republicans and the Democrats, are now kind of bought in a way that they weren't. It was more of a Democratic phenom, the tech thing, in the last cycle. And I do think we're also watching a larger context where the frustration with government, the paralysis with government, the polarization of politics, I think prefaces a real explosive kind of period here that's going to really, I go as far as thinking it's going to really reinvent government and reinvent it in a pretty thorough way here in the country in the next 10, 20 years. I think there's a lot of parallels to previous periods in history, if you want to go there. I mean, mm-hmm. That's too much detail. That there's been essentially a series of reinventions of American government over the past 200 years, and every one follows the same pattern of the old system breaks down, the old system gets paralyzed, the two sides polarize and go back to their roots trying to figure out the way forward by looking backward. That doesn't solve it, and then there's essentially, it prefaces what always has been about a 10 to 15 year period of just crazy innovation in government, and across American society, actually. And I would go as far as saying a reinvention of how you essentially do America And I think the last time we saw it, obviously, was coming off the war and the post-war. Before that was the progressive era. Before that was around the Civil War. And I would go as far without being too hyperbolic about it. I think there's a lot of the conditions for essentially that level of reinvention going the next 10, 15 years here.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'm an optimist. I've been doing a lot of speaking on this, and it's been resonating with a lot of folks, and I got my own site, which is peterleiden.com. You know, you can see some of the thinking there. I've just launched it and still a work in progress, but I'm actually got a project going called the Reinvent America that I'm basically going to be doing a series of a bunch of work around this space, because I'm convinced we're seeing this starting to bite in a way that's ready for prime time.
I'll send you
some slides. But again, I don't want to monopolize the call here, but I'm just...
That
was too much. I had to come out of the lurking here.
That was great.
Conversation.
That was
Peter,
great.
Is that Leiden, L-E-I or L-E-Y?
L-E-Y.
It's Peter Leiden, L-E-Y-D-E-N. Again, I just launched this site a few weeks ago. But
like the jar in the city.
Think about that.
I assume you've seen the Rebooting America document that the Personal Democracy Forum did about 4 years ago. Still
absolutely,
one of the
and I was at PDF. Exactly. I was at PDF, just a fact. And actually, again, in this kind of future scenario thing, one of the coolest things out there, I'll just kind of throw out there, was for those who weren't there, was Jaron Lanier, who, you know, largely credited his early thinking on virtual reality and other things. Actually, he laid out a fascinating talk of essentially a way that you could essentially bolster a 21st century middle class based on really deep links back to everything anyone actually originates, essentially would get kind of paid in micropayments as a kind of a radically alternative way to essentially support a vibrant middle class with the kind of, given the kind of mechanization of everything that's often supported the middle class going forward. And it was the first time PDF was really thinking, in my opinion, at that really much more meta deep think
Peter,
level, as opposed to how do we improve politics.
How is Jaron Lanier's vision different from Ted Nelson's Xanadu project? Because it sounds exactly like it.
Well, Jared actually played with that exactly. He said the original vision of course, the web was that you'd have these permanent links back, that you would, even in mashups and stuff, be able to parse out what went into it and actually compensate people for it. In fact, he was using that as an inspiration since he's been around for so long.
Interesting.
And you're absolutely right. It was the earliest part. But he was kind of playing with it with this sense of, hey, what happens when, I mean, you start getting, you know, automatically driven cars, like, you know, the Google car starts to knock out the trucking industry and the truckers, you know, who kind of have held a middle class lifestyle. And then the taxi drivers, who also have been holding the middle class lifestyle. And he started then thinking, in a world that that's starting to go, you know, what really is really radically new thinking about sustainable ways that you can actually do that. Now, it wasn't the answer for the truck driver per se, but it was a sense that there's another way you could compensate people over the course of their lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you built enough of these kind of compensation, micro compensations going in the, you know, prime year life, it would actually play out because you could kind of live off that in your retirement.
It's passive income.
A really different way to think of that. Exactly. It was a kind of interesting thing. Anyhow, that was another way that I think it was, I think all these spaces that, because I've been in this space since like 2004, a lot of these spaces that were very practical about how do we use these things to just, you know, do better politics or get something done a little bit better, I think is now morphing into the really bigger picture stuff, which is like, how could we redesign American society to fit the new norms of the 21st century, which is everything has chips, everything's interlinked, everything's global, everything has to be sustainable. And if you really think at that level, fresh and clean and more bold, you know, a lot of wild stuff could come up. And I my gut feeling is we're going to see a lot more of that coming in the next 5 to 10 years.
So, Pete, I don't know if you were on early in the call, but Bo talked about Sheldon Raynon's essay on netness, which starts with the same sets of premises. I'd be very interested in sort of taking a super collider and mashing together Jaron Lanier with Sheldon Raynon. That would be a very interesting explosion.
Well, let's make that happen. I could help.
That'd be very fun.
And as a small...
Well, let's have Jaron Lanier to the forum so I could see him, because I was thinking the same. Jaron Lanier,
J-A-R-O-N. Very interesting guy, lives in the Berkeley Hills.
He testified before Senator Gore back in 1990 in the very first and perhaps last hearing on virtual reality.
Wow.
You can imagine Jaron in front of a bunch of senators. It was pretty surreal.
Large fellow with
Jaron
with dreadlocks.
Very distinct. I think he's doing something now with, I think Microsoft Research, frankly, is, he had some association with them.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. Just as a small historic side trip here, one of my first ever interviews in Silicon Valley when I started out in this business was with a fellow named Roger Nelson. I think no relation to you, Mike. He was the CEO of the Xanadu company, which was in the mission of building this vision of Ted Nelson's. And they were on California Street in Palo Alto, so not University Avenue, but down further near what was used to be Printers, Inc. I remember we went for sushi afterward, but he was the first actual real geek I'd ever met. He had a very large, apparently hairy pot belly with a t-shirt a couple sizes too small over it, thick glasses that had a green film inside, and a big beard. And he was talking about how they were going to be done in about 2 years. So imagine my amusement to see an article in 2002. And so the date of that interview is probably 92 or something like that. Then imagine my surprise in 2002 or 3 to see an article somewhere in the tech press about how Xanadu is still 2 years away from shipping their platform. So anyway. This apparently stuck in my head quite a long time ago. We're getting near the end of our call period, and I'm going to have to do the summary pretty soon. I just want to invite a couple of summarizing comments from anybody who'd like to jump in, trends you're seeing and hearing from what we're saying, whatever else you'd like to add to our conversation, then I'll summarize and take us out.
Well, I just want to thank the whole group because this was not depressing and nihilistic. Thank you. I feel a little hope.
I did see some glimmers of hope. There, it depends on who you are and where you stand in the industry, but I did see a lot of slivers of hope. Thanks, Bo.
When are we going to do this next, Jerry? Because we haven't done childcare, we haven't done food, we haven't done energy, we haven't done transportation. We've only got about 15% of the economy covered so far.
I would love to go back to it. So thanks for recommending that. It's sort of like in the call we had last call, I think, which was about what should we talk about on Yitan. I think it was you or somebody said, hey, let's go back to abundance also, because we'd only just scratched the surface of that topic. So I think this merits revisiting as well. So I'd love to do that. Thanks,
and
Mike.
I'd love to do the Sheldon lash up about open government and get Sheldon on. That would be nice, too.
Sheldon would be great to have as a guest. I totally agree. I think that'd be a great call. Whether or not we can do Sheldon plus Jaron might be too much for a call, but I think a call about netness would be really terrific. Anybody else? Closing comments? And Michael Drasnan on the IRC says he wants the depressing and nihilistic version.
I saw that.
And Peter Kepik corrects me. He's totally right. My memory was wrong. It was not Roger Nelson, who I think was a band leader in the old days. It was Roger Gregory. You're totally right, Peter. Thank you. Good. So there being no further comments of that sort, let me stare at my notes and see what we said, because we covered a lot of ground. We started out with Dick Karpinski talking really about the breaks, the corruption between research on the pharma medical side and universities, and how somebody from the New England Journal of Medicine was stating, or somebody related to it, was stating that half the articles in recent journals have kind of been false because research is being run largely by corporations. Pip interjected and said, look, I really don't like it when we start talking about how corporate money equals evil. That's not an okay conversation. Let's not go negative here. And we didn't go that negative. I think we sprinkled sort of salt and pepper through the whole call. We had a bunch of things that were hard to talk about, and then a bunch of glimmers of light. As Bo said at the very end, he was happy that this was an optimistic call. So then I pushed Dick for a while to say, well, okay, how does that play out? Where does that go? And he pointed to a book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, which I need to look up and put in my brain, and talked about how violence has been reduced, violence between us, and how a lot of things that were kind of socially normal years ago are now unthinkable to do, which makes me laugh because I'm almost through watching Deadwood. And, you know, the way people interact in Deadwood is hard to imagine in downtown Palo Alto or San Francisco or wherever else as well. So we talked a bunch about the internet offering new opportunities for transparency, and I mentioned Don Tapscott's talk, his opening talk at TED Global recently, and brought him up a couple times, but transparency being one of his four forces around openness. Bo took us into the area of brain implants, MRI, devices, and devices not being open, but a lot of this stuff becoming more and more hackable, open, DIY, fabbable in different ways. I pointed to an article that just came out in the Wall Street Journal about ICDs, which are defibrillators that are implantable. And there's this whole notion of hacking brains and bodies. Maybe it's the convergence of the automobile tuner culture with life hacking and hacker spaces with a medical and wellness bent. I think that's a really beautiful and interesting space to do something in. Bo talked about super-enabled people and this whole notion of how we go there and how we might tip people's brains toward higher performance. We then, Bo brought in Sheldon Raynon and his essay on netness. There's a link on the IRC, and talking about how we're all just getting connected and how we're moving from three previous states, sort of system states, to maybe four, where the old three are loosely connected entities, tightly connected and embedded entities, and now Sheldon is proposing entanglement, entangled entities, entangled in fields. So, you know, how that might play out, who knows? I pointed out that I'm quoted in a recent Pew Internet study on the Internet of Things. I'm pretty skeptical about this Internet of Things actually working properly. In particular, I think it's beautifully and eminently hackable, because once you've embedded a circuit and put it out in the field, nobody's going to go back and upgrade it, and its firmware upgradability will be exhausted pretty quickly. So we talked then about pharmaceuticals going in, and I mentioned Tapscott talking about the pharmaceutical cliff that's coming up, the patent cliff that's being hit, and how that's going to happen. And we talked around this for a bit in different ways. So Mike Nelson said, well, a lot of companies are shifting over toward devices that people need to have all the time and looking toward annuity revenues. A friend of his has apnea, and he keeps getting solicited, hey, there's new equipment available for your apnea. And then he mentioned a neti pot, and it was this remarkable coincidence that I just ordered a neti pot this morning online. So maybe they want to keep selling me saline solution, but I got to say, saline is a lot easier to make than some kind of other things you might think of. But the razor blade and razor model came up a little bit, at least in our heads. So annuities are okay. Businesses trying to figure out how to make annuity businesses probably are better than the big lottery jackpot, as Jay Cross said, the slot machine jackpot business that pharma has developed so far. Just before that, I talked about how there's a lot of research on the microbiome, and I see a lot of real benefit there, and potentially a lot of breakthroughs on dealing with disease as a social and multi-scale issue, not just let's go kill all the bacteria so we get better. Mike also said, well, maybe what the companies are doing is trying to convince more and more people that they're sick all the time to get those annuity revenues. So Jay took us into this whole notion that Japanese didn't really have the word depression in their lexicon until recently, and now there's all sorts of articles and all sorts of publicity and PR, and they are now gigantic consumers of antidepressant medicines. We talked a bit about mood meds and how that might work, and Dick Karpinski jumped back in and said, well, some of this might be just done with games and for cheap. He pointed to Superbetter, which is Jane McGonigal's game startup, which is about helping people get rid of depression and migraines and other sorts of things by collecting up their posse and helping each other, which sounds like a great thing. So I see a general broad trend here that many sorts of things can be done for free now and are not good for GDP and are really good for our wellness and long-term happiness. And Mike said, well, those dollars are probably just going to shift. If we're not spending it on drugs and trying to, you know, medicate ourselves into stasis or into some sort of mollified happiness, maybe we'll spend it on ecotourism or on massages or on something else. Jay said, well, you know, sometimes we can be overly optimistic. A friend of his has very severe Parkinson's and needed to be helped into bed, but he pulled out a vial of Viagra and said, here, got this along in case I get lucky. And just how off on reality that was. Jay also pointed out that placebos seem to work even if you know they are placebos. And he talked about how Jeff U. Boys jumped in and said that there's a statistic that from 1996 to 2005, the number of people on antidepressants, I believe, in the U.S. doubled. And he pointed to this whole notion about, are we heading into a Huxley or an Orwell future? And maybe Huxley is winning here. Are we going to be sort of medicated to death or entertained to death? Neither of those is particularly nice. The movie I point to all the time when talking about those things is Wall-E, which I think was a lovely touch point for where we might be headed. Bo then said, let's talk about finance. And he brought in an IMF study that said that debt is pretty good for GDP and for growth as long as it's somewhere around 80 to 100% of GDP. Above that, it starts getting pretty toxic, and we're now around 200% of GDP. So this is getting pretty bad. I proposed three future scenarios for financial worlds, in particular derivatives and financial innovations. A would be the status quo just keeps getting on. B would be there's some large regulatory regime that comes back in and manages to corral these things and make some of them, more scrutinized, more illegal, more whatever. And C is sort of the boof scenario where the whole thing just explodes and money breaks. Bo pointed out that, deflation is a problem too. We could have a cycle where we get hit strongly by deflation and then hyperinflation. And he gives a 60% chance that scenario C actually happens, that this thing just sort of breaks. Jeff, you boys talked about the euro, and he said, well, is the euro going to keep going? What happens here? Is risk priced into it now, or what's going to go on? And Mike said, well, maybe what happens is the euro survives, but large transactions go elsewhere. We've had these sort of pseudo-currencies before, he points out, in lots of different places. And I brought in an example from the book 1493 about China, which for a long time had dual currency systems where ordinary people bought and sold things in brass coins that had a square hole through the middle. And then large things were all done in silver, which is why China had this insatiable appetite for silver. I mentioned also the yuan, which is a market basket currency, and how that could work. Jeff brought up income inequality and said, now this is a speakable term. It used to be we couldn't really even talk about it. So how will wealth concentrations play out? And I pointed out that wealth concentrations and food shortages are those two things that tend to lead to revolutions. Bo mentioned an Economist article that says that incomes just really are not growing. Quantitative easing has not helped. And the U.S. now has a real underclass. We've had a failure of education, and we're incarcerating a huge proportion of the population, really a big number. So, and we're starting to get problems where people are in permanent unemployment. Like once you've been in jail, good luck getting a job as a felon. And in Europe, they have, you know, lots of people on permanent disability. We're heading down that path as well. And then there's these ossifying seniority systems and bureaucratic curricula and all kinds of problems. So I proposed that education will be eaten from the outside in over the next couple decades. And I think that's a really optimistic thing to have happen. Not so good if you're one of the institutions that's in the middle of it, unless you can figure out how to shift, how to change. So Jay stepped into the conversation away from a little bit of email, and we talked about informal learning and working smarter and this real divide between educational systems and corporations. He's really focusing on purposeful learning, and he thinks there's a big transfer of control going on where we let people be more autonomous. He just came back from the STOS gathering, STOOS, in Switzerland, which sounded like a really awesome get-together. Look online for some of the materials that came out of that. And then he pointed us to India, where, you know, India wants to educate 800 million people now, so they're going to go out and build 30,000 new colleges. And I think we all, he and I at least, sort of shrugged and go, oi, because it's not about building the old structures of education. It's really about shifting the way that learning is done as a function that might get them there. So Mike said, look, my big question here in education is what happens to credentials and credentialing? Is your LinkedIn recommendation list going to become your new credential? How does this happen and how does it change the game for universities? Because right now they have a monopoly on credentialing. Jay said, well, you kind of have to segment the market here. How does that look? And Mike said, well, look at access to networks, which is part of what you get when you go to school. The people you meet, the networks you create, is that replaceable too? They said, well, Harvard's probably not going anywhere. They have an endowment that's, you know, more money than God has, et cetera. But I think we're talking about a real shift in the rhythm of work, life, and education in our lives. Maybe we'll work for 8 years and then go to school for a year and then dive back in. Maybe, as Dick Karpinski said next, we'll be much more flexible about what a job actually is. That we'll use the Hollywood studio model more. And the thing we didn't talk about at that moment in the conversation that I forgot to bring in later was one of the things that makes Hollywood studio model work really well is that there are these very highly defined roles. Like everybody knows what a gaffer is and what the cinematographer does and where their responsibilities begin and end and what it means to be a good one. So that works really well. And then to roll backwards a little bit also, Mike Nelson pointed out, not enough people look at time budgets, at how people use their time over time, and because that's really a strong, strong indicator of major secular shifts. Mike talked about a recent article, The Rise of the Supertemp, and says the word of the decade should be giganomics, this new studio model of even very powerful people coming in for short-term engagements in different ways and then going off. And the giganomics may not just be an individual economy, I'll add this in here, it may also be about squads that love to work together and are very high capacity, high function together. And Dick then took us back toward healthcare, saying, well, you know, the future of healthcare here may be irrelevant in that way as we start to dissolve away from the large corporations, which is where healthcare is currently glued to as an artifact of World War II. Mike talked about, you know, at the end, why don't we talk about the future of government? He sees the convergence of sensors, big data, social media, identity, all sorts of things just coming together in different ways. Maybe, as a few people are proposing these days, I think Tim O'Reilly's one of them, maybe information systems could just be wired together so that the SEC or the EPA or somebody else can be watching in and be doing automatic monitoring. I think O'Reilly's calling it algorithmic regulation. So this might be a much better connection between citizens, the government, and corporations. You know, this would let corporations document what they're doing and not have to stick to ossified rules about how exactly you report and what you do. Bo talked about pot regulations in Colorado, where there was kind of chaos for a while, and the growers and the sellers demanded regulation, and they tried to find ways to get rid of the gangs and the violence and the other stuff around it. Mike Nelson pointed to Vladimir Putin, who, in the interest of transparency in the latest electoral cycle, put cameras in voting areas, and, you know, 10,000 of these apparently, so that they could monitor fraud, and they put electronic locks on the vote on the voting boxes, etc. He managed, of course, still to swing the election in other ways. Pete Lydon jumped into the conversation, coming out of lurking for a while, and he said, yes, there's a huge change going on. This government thing is what I care about and do. And he talked about some of his history, and then he talked about how he sees lots of experimentation going on, that the Democrats and the Republicans seem to be bought in now, that change is happening, and that people are tired of the paralysis and the polarization, that that tends to lead toward explosions or at least reinvention. And he says, look, there have been many previous reinventions in the U.S. that follow this pattern. The old system starts to break down, you get strong polarization, then you get the progressive era, the Civil War, and aftermath, you get a whole bunch of things. He's got a project called Reinvent America. Mike asked, have you seen the Rebooting Democracy document that came out? And Pete said, yep, I think I was at that PDF, et cetera, et cetera. Then Pete talked about Jaron Lanier giving a talk recently, a fascinating talk about how to bolster the 21st century middle class based on what they've already achieved and getting payments for it. And I asked, well, how is that different from the Xanadu Project? And he said, well, actually, Lanier points to the Xanadu Project and says he was inspired by it. But imagine we could all live off of passive income later on in our lives. So I told a little story about Roger Gregory from Xanadu Corp way back when. And then we conjectured what would it be like to mash together Jaron Lanier and Sheldon Raynon with his netness hypothesis in a sort of super collider chamber at the Large Hadron Collider or something. But I think we should bring Sheldon on into a Yitan call. So Mike at the end said, hey, when are we having another one of these calls? This was pretty cool. And we've missed half the sectors in the economy. We haven't talked about childcare, food, energy, transport. It's a whole bunch of other places to go. So I will do that. I will put it into the schedule. And that brings us to the end of Industry Futures, the 371st Yitan Tech Community Call held on Monday, July 16th, 2012. Thank you all for joining us from the bottom of my little heart. Feel free to add comments and pages on yitan.com. And please tell your colleagues to join us again in 3 Mondays. We have a buy in there because it's the 30th of this month. On August 6th, when we'll start a 2-part series about education. We're going to start with rethinking education from the inside out. And then we're going to talk about rethinking education from the outside in. And I'll explain that distinction later on. I'm Jerry Mikulski. Thank you again, and goodbye for now.
This podcast is published under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 3.0 license. It was edited and published by Sasha Merkailo. Thanks again for listening.